We aren't having a large turnover in the villagers' population. Some of you were probably here yesterday, but I'll go through the routine again. I'm Carlisle Holte. And I was sort of hedging yesterday because there are so many people from Washington here, and there seems to be a little rivalry between Washington State and Minnesota, so I maintained I was from North Dakota, and we are one of those endangered species, so he'd have to be nice to me. Then I find out a lady here who comes from where my folks came from, in southern Minnesota, Fillmore County. That always sounds good, and I do meet people here who are from St. Olaf, and I myself went to Concordia Moorhead. And of course, when I say North Dakota, there are people who sidle up to me and say, I'm from North Dakota, too.
If it's any comfort or sorrow to you, I was born in Northview.
And look what's happened to you now. Here you are.
I'm in here pitching, listening to you.
Well, I like to start out with something lighter, you know. And two things today. This nose is not the result of heavy drinking. I was raised in the kind of a home where you didn't learn that. But I sat up on the porch of the chalet that we're occupying for a while this forenoon, and after some cold days, first week we were here, I'm getting thawed out pretty thoroughly now. And I would like to be thawed out so that I will not get frozen up again before we leave on Sunday. But I had that, and I could just sort of feel myself thawing, and at the same time, I almost needed basting. And then my wife had been talking about the jacuzzi. So I went with her to the jacuzzi and spent some time there, got thawed out some more, and I got out first and stood in the sun and got dried off in the sun. But I think I know what happened all over. You've heard of Baked Alaska? You ever seen Baked North Dakota? That's irrelevant. But I mentioned last evening in my Vesper meditation a story in a different book of Paul Scherer's that I picked up in the library here, the particular book, For We Have This Treasure, that I relied on for the stress on this treasure idea last evening. Not here. And I'm not giving them my copy. They'll have to buy their own or go without. But there's another book by Sharon, much the same character. And I thought about him and one of his stories. Again, quite irrelevant, except so much as it concerns God. And that's what we're talking about in the ultimate. Sharon was a mighty preacher in New York and lectured on preaching at Union Theological Seminary. And somebody had told me, oh, he was really in sartorial splendor. He dressed like a preacher, and he had that metropolitan mien. He came to St. Olaf at our summer theological conference some years ago, and I saw him at first hand, introduced him at a discussion session, and it was warm. He wanted to take off his suit jacket. And I've never seen this in any other man. I was going to put it carefully over the back of a chair, so I took it, you know, and laid it the way I would do my own, like this, you know, shoulders over. Thought I'd done a pretty good job. You know, he said, that's not the way to do it. You turn the jacket inside out, so the lining is out, and the good material is protected. Well, along with this other aspect of the cultured New Yorker, there is a story that he cites in this book, and he was also a reader, clearly, of the New Yorker magazine, which has some marvelous cartoons. This particular cartoon has, very evidently, one of these sort of sandwich boards that you would see in a place like that, and the bearded gentleman carrying it is reminding people, with big printed letters on the board, prepare to meet thy God. And somebody has apparently come by and seen that, and then he finds a little mirror on a gum machine. So he's there combing his hair and straightening his tie. I just thought of that again as I combed my hair down the way here. Well, this is the second in this week's series on God and faith in autobiography, not coming out quite the same as the series 2 weeks ago now, but I think, it's helping me to take a little fresh titling and a little reordering. So I've announced today the topic, God is God. And I did touch on that briefly yesterday. For the benefit of those who didn't get the announcement yesterday, there is a copy of Lewis's spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, in the library down the corridor here and to the right, and the shelf against the window. That is a reserve book which you may read there. And I checked, there is also, for those who wouldn't probably want to get involved with some reading, I don't blame you, some sort of heavy stuff, a delightful book of pictures relating to Lewis's life, some of his hiking experiences, some of his friends, his marriage very late in life, and just a delightful collection, including also some of the work that he did as a very lonely child, writing stories and illustrating them. They're pretty good for sort of a lower grades kid. And they were preserved and they have been put there. And I think not all of it, but a selection of them, so you can get an idea of the kind of imagination that he manifested early. That's sort of propaganda for tomorrow, and I will be talking, at least at the outset, about what Lewis called a baptized imagination. In the bookstore also, there were, just not too many minutes ago, some copies of this for sale, and near to it, a small book, which primarily is a description of the grief experience Lewis went through after the death of his wife from cancer. It is called A Grief Observed, and that has value in itself. It has been padded to make a little larger book. Just that section on the grief experience would be more of a pamphlet than a book. So one of his admirers added what is something of a retelling of Surprised by Joy and some other aspects of Lewis's life. You might at least look at it. And unfortunately, I don't find a copy of A Grief Observed on the table. If you're going to the window, you will have to go around that table. That has a shelf like that, or bookends like that, of Lewis's writings. He was quite prolific. Maybe A Grief Observed is there. At any rate, if this looks too fat, in A Grief Observed there is a short life of Lewis and gets at some of the same ideas. Now clearly, I have not, even in the longer series, tried to be comprehensive. And although I made quite a bit in that longer series of this God is God idea, I want to give perhaps even more emphasis to it. And usually we make selections of topics, whether we are selecting a free text and not following the pericope or the lectionary, we choose because we're interested in it, or because we feel that now here is something that ought to be called to our attention. And I think you will get something perhaps from too much intensity of my feeling that the contemporary American Christian Church does not adequately communicate the sense of the glory of God, His majesty, His holiness. And that's what I tried to point up in the very briefest form possible. God is God. Some of the language that we use, whether to address God in prayer or to proclaim him in personal witness or in public proclamation, gives a sense of a God who is smaller. The allegation is made sometimes that some people put God in a box. We get him all wrapped up like a gift. And then we put gift wrapping around it and stick one of those bows on top, and there is God. Well, some of this phenomenon really arises from the fact that we are overly New Testament Christian. That is, we find there the witness of God in Jesus Christ. We see the New Testament as our scripture, and the Old Testament is so much bigger and so much more complicated that we tend to ignore it. We even ignore the Psalms, where we could get at some of this notion very readily if we bothered to read and reread the Psalms. In the Old Testament scripture, which is, after all, the Bible still of the Jewish people, and rightly so, that awesome sense of the greatness of God, the holiness of God, comes at us in recurring waves. It is always there. The response is, in many of the leading characters there, one of a fearful reverence before God. There is no attempt to make God palsy-wowsy, to make him a commonplace. We could use the word, and sometimes we have to do that when we're talking about aspects of theology out of autobiography, of supernaturalism. To see God as one of our chorales has it, "Thou so high enthroned above me." In Lewis's work, I think that this aspect of God is a constant element. And in his spiritual development, it is a very significant aspect. I'm going to make a different approach than I have before, and for good or ill, concentrate on a more limited segment. And that isn't because I can't use all of these stop sheets that I have in here, but there is so much saying what I want stressed that I can go along for about four pages here and pick out segments, not everything, because that would be too difficult for me to communicate well. Here is where I'm going to start, on page 226. And for those of you who were here yesterday, we stressed that Lewis describes his own spiritual pilgrimage as coming from atheism to the Christian faith. So here he writes, "Really, a young atheist cannot guard his faith too carefully. Dangers lie in wait for him on every side. You must not do... You must not even try to do the will of a father unless you are prepared to know of the doctrine." Some of you may well have read what I think is one of the most delightful and yet significant books of C.S. Lewis. I think it has been printed and reprinted more than any other book he ever wrote. It is the Screwtape Letters. Part of his imagination, pardon me for getting on to tomorrow. But he has a way of just giving crazy names. Screwtape and Wormwood are two demons. And the Screwtape Letters, the introduction says, fell into his hands. They were correspondence between a sort of a demon in training and an experienced, degreed, and tenured demon. And a lot of it is very tongue-in-cheek. but it is also very incisive. And what you read here is of that same character. A young atheist cannot guard his faith too carefully. That sort of strikes us, and it has an irony in it, but it also says something practical. Because we look probably with envy at the atheists who have their condition and their outlook so assured. And we admit that we have to examine and re-examine, and we go to church and we are told to study more and think through and, you know, be ready to give an answer to every person. And we don't have those answers, we better work on it. But here, Lewis flips it and says, well, if you're going to be a real atheist, you got to be on the watch. It doesn't just come so easily. And particularly, because if you follow your atheistic tendencies, you're going to get closer to destroying your own position. Let's try to do the will of the Father. Unless you are, you must not try to do it. You must not sort of become serious unless you are prepared to know of the doctrine, in quotes. All my acts, desires, and thoughts were to be brought into harmony with universal spirit. And that's part of his spiritual progression. But, you see, he is not trying to become a believer in God, and certainly not a believer in Christ. But because of this universal spirit, which he's trying to follow, this is what happened. There I found what appalled me, a zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. My name was Legion. We'll go on with more of this. I think we begin to get a sense that Lewis found when he had some earnestness about, you could say, any religion, that he is moving away from indifference and negativism to where he is opening up to biblical truths. And so here again, he plays verbal tricks. My name is Legion. And there you are in one of the New Testament stories about the demon-possessed man. Jesus says, who are you? My name is Legion. There are all kinds of us. And Jesus drives out the legion of demons. Well, Lewis wasn't concerned about that. But he is finding out, because he gets serious even about this vague business of spirit, that he is not a very spiritual person in a good sense. The spirits that are in him are demonic. Now this sort of thing, I know, sounds old hat. I don't look on you as tempted to say the church is way behind the times, or we've got to discard this or that. But I know there are people who, when the word demon is brought into the conversation, or devil, say, that's at least 19th century, probably older. And yet I find in writings that aren't intended to be sort of evangelical or evangelistic, when people say what's going on in the world, they will use the term demonic things are going on. Another of the books that I use in used, I have to mind my language, I've been saying, I'm not sure that some of my preacher friends here are really retired, and I'm saying I'm retired, but my verbs betray it to me. When I was teaching, before the end of May, I used a book by a quite liberally minded young man who is now teaching at the University of Chicago. His name is Langdon Gilkey. He was swept up by the Japanese after they won control of an area of China. And all of the non-Orientals were put into a detention camp. Not a concentration camp. They were in no danger, but they went through some harshness in terms of limitation of space and food and heat and so on. Now, guilty at that time did not believe in original sin, did not believe in old-fashioned ideas such as the demonic. And it wasn't that he kept going to the Wednesday evening prayer meetings either. It was that he saw how people could be greedy of their own rights and privileges, their own space, and could resist common sense. Rooms that should have held only a couple of people, it was a former missionary compound, now had to hold 10 people. He tells the story of how, quite by accident, in one of those rooms there were 11 men, in the other there were 9. Well, the 11 men were very crowded, and they said, it would give us just a little bit more space. If you could reassign, one man could go in and we would have 2 rooms, each with 10. They wanted it. But the 9 men said, here we are. It's tough about those poor fellows there. They are crowded, but so are we. We are not taking a 10th man in here. Absolutely not. And the irony in this and other instances, people were getting up in the middle of the night, and they had to mark out how far their beds could go with chalk on the floor, but they'd get up in the middle of the night, and then they'd remark the floor. Well, the Japanese were not notable for their goodness, but they were in charge, and the things that these Westerners could not arbitrate among themselves finally had to be settled by force. Called in the Japanese and said, we can't get them to give in. The Japanese simply moved in and said, this person is going to go in here, 10 and 10. We like to think about ourselves as rational, as considerate, as concerned, and what's the phrase now? Susan used it, when push comes to shove. These people were selfish to the point of the demonic. And Gilkey uses that term. Okay. Let's get on with something more here. There is a need to consider the holiness of God. Well, I have tried to stay away from the heavier aspects of doctrine, theology. It's hard enough when you have a class period or two or three to talk about somebody like Paul Tillich. But Paul Tillich is a great theologian of the 20th century, one of the greatest, and he espoused a statement where he saw religion as ultimate concern. This doesn't sound very catechetical or very much in the pulpit, but one thing that can be seen in his use of that phrase is that religion should be something passionate, something driving, ultimate. It should be a real concern. Now, this is what I hear Lewis talking about, and he didn't know that much about Tillich as far as anything I've seen in him, but he is still describing some spiritual movement that begins to operate when he pursues things with some sense of urgency. If he just sat back and said, well, I'm an atheist, don't talk about it. Well, this is my position, I'm a spiritualist. That's it. But he begins to follow through, and that's when he says, that's dangerous. And sometimes what is needed to get people out of some kind of religious mire is that they simply begin to look more earnestly at it. I know we are plagued by the question, why do people belong to some of these strange cults? And sometimes the only reason that we can give is that they were suckered into it, and they are never allowed to engage in serious question. We talk about brainwashing, and that is simply saying, well, somebody knows better than you just listen now and you take it, and don't listen to all these other people. close the gates, don't let people in, we'd watch the literature. Hardest-nosed kind of exclusivism. And I think it is well for us to take the stance within the mainstream Christendom that we are free to examine. We do not have to put barriers around people so they don't hear anybody else than the preacher in the Fifth Avenue X Church. And it's not a matter of saying, well, then we're going to be free to go everywhere. But it simply says, if we will take God seriously, we will be led into a deeper relationship than if we just say, well, no doubt we have the truth, and we don't have to talk about it anymore. We don't want to hear how anybody else feels or how others within the Christian church feel. Now, this example of taking faith seriously is certainly well exemplified in the case of the Apostle Paul. Again, here, in some very casual reading of Scherer, he said, we must remember that Paul was converted from religion, not from irreligion, not from atheism. He was passionately religious. He was persecuting the Christians because he believed earnestly that that was the way to serve God. Do you remember how he was challenged by the voice from heaven? It is hard to kick against the pricks. Something in his very intensity was raising a question in his harshness and in what he'd heard in the gospel, and he was resisting it, which opened up the prospect of that great conversion. On a subsequent page, Lewis writes something that probably pleases us almost too much when he says that it was not a time to play at philosophy. And here too, of course, philosophy for a large part of the general population is sort of a luxury enjoyed by sophisticates. All philosophers do is train others to philosophize. Sometimes I can share your feeling that all philosophers do is train some young students to mouth somebody else's words and to quote this philosopher or this philosopher theologian or that one, and they are completely single-minded about this. They are the most on-thinking followers, almost cultists in this regard. Now, Lewis was a philosopher in his sort of first incarnation as a teacher. But he learns here also that philosophy, if it keeps pressing, will move him out of false reliance on a philosophy. Now he begins to use some language also. That's typical Lewis. My adversary, and adversary here is with a capital A, waived the point. And that's out of context, but he is talking here about God as his opponent. The heading at the top of this page, indicating the chapter title, is out of chess, checkmate. Those of you who have played some chess realize that that is the point where one player has succeeded in reducing the men of the other player and getting the last pieces in such a position that they cannot escape. That's the end of the game. Checkmate. So here you have in the whole chapter, the chess game, Lewis is playing against God. And God has read the book and Lewis hasn't. And then he has an adversary. We'll see how that comes in again and again. God would not argue about it. He only said, I am the Lord. I am that I am. I am. That's why God is God. When Moses stopped to see the burning bush that was not consumed, he wanted to know God's name. I am that I am. That's my name. And language can reduce that to limited box proportions. Well, God is being. But there's something more majestic here, and the term the Lord still communicates. We are not that kind of society anymore. That opening hymn, "Crown Him Lord of All." By the way, did you all hear that Diana had her baby boy named Henry? So after all these centuries of having only Henry VIII, there's at least somebody who will be down the line eligible, Henry. I guess they're going to call him by a little more youthful name. But we do know enough. Probably it's a good thing we have royal families still. So that kingship and lordship, and I love what you all did last evening with that opening hymn, "Crown Him Lord of All." By the way, did you all hear that Diana had her baby boy named Henry? So after all these centuries of having only Henry VIII, there's at least somebody who will be down the line eligible, Henry. I guess they're going to call him by a little more youthful name.
Hank.
Hank? Harry? Harry, that was what they called King Henry VIII, I think. Harry, I don't know how it got to be. But lordship, kingship. You run across delightful stories sometimes about queens, too. We're supposed to use inclusive language. Sometimes people presume about kings and queens. And you've heard about Queen Victoria, who probably is second only in terms of her length of, I don't know about the length of her reign, but the kind of reign that she gave English to Queen Elizabeth, who was quite a gal. Somebody in the court, in the presence of Queen Victoria, told a story that was not really to her liking, and she was a pretty starchy lady, and we still talk about the Victorian age. And all she said was, using the regal we are not amused. A put down. I am the queen. I do not listen to that sort of thing. Now, it isn't like the queen in Alice in Wonderland, who says, off with his head. But it is still the solemnity of lordship. Just a bit more here. People who are naturally religious find difficulty in understanding the horror of such a revelation, that is, I am the Lord. Amiable agnostics will talk cheerfully about man's search for God. To me, as I then was, they might as well have talked about the mouse's search for the cat. That's my kind of writing and poetry and humor, and it's a put-down. I think somewhere, and it's probably in Luther, practically everything is there because he talked so much, the way to handle the devil is to make fun of him, to sneer at him. And Lewis has learned that lesson. So he does sneer at the devil. He also sneers at some of the religious people. Now, we are rather too mannerly here. We are likely to want to be very tolerant. And so when we see something that is incongruous, that is taught or practiced in the name of Christ, we don't say, oh, come on. That's foolish. I always say, well, everybody to his taste. And the thing is about this man's search for God, Lewis calls them amiable agnostics. But the amiable agnostics were writing serious books. I've probably still got one of them. Man's Search for God, exactly that title. And there are theologians who are constantly talking about, that's what's going on. It sounds glorious. We must realize that man is searching for God. And we have this clue in that. It's pretty hard to avoid it, I imagine, since one reason that I have kept a reasonably subdued figure is that I have eaten a lot of my own words, and they are quite indigestible, and you lose weight over them. But I know in my theological mind, we don't search for God. God comes to us. And this, too, is it's sort of high-level theology. To throw out another name, Karl Barth, another of the great theologians of this century, spent a great deal of attention on this because he was hearing it in Europe when he came to America, and he heard it there, too. Man is searching for God. At the same time, he seemed to be searching for land and for blood and soil and pure Arianism, and where all the Jews were so you could destroy their shops and put them in railroad cars and send them off to the gas chambers. Man was searching for God. The evidences seem to raise a question. God searching for us. And this opens up for me to quote some powerful lines that are not expressly used by Lewis, but I'm sure he was quite aware of them. There's a parallel story that took place about the same time as C.S. Lewis's conversion, in that his older brother came back to the faith. And his older brother, who did keep a journal, made special note of having read this poem, The Hound of Heaven, by Francis Thompson. Francis Thompson was for a long time a derelict. In that time, he would have been known simply as a drunkard. They did not call it alcoholism. He was a stumble bum. He was taken care of by some loving people and underwent spiritual renewal, a conversion. And he wrote some strong poetry, including this poem, The Hound of Heaven. Now, this is not a biblical phrase to talk about God as a dog chasing after us, coming out of heaven and lapping away, you know, and barking and terrifying us, does not sound very much like the God of even the Old Testament. But it has this idea of the pursuit of love, the love that will not let us go. And here is one stanza only. It's rich and complicated in its poetry, but it is very honest because Thompson, out of his own experience, couldn't say anything else that, now God was after me, but I was running away from him. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinth and ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him and under running laughter. Up vistaed hopes I sped, and shot precipitated adown titanic glooms of chasmed fears from those strong feet that followed after. But with unhurrying chase and unperturbed pace, deliberate speed, majestic instancy, they beat, and the voice beat more instant than the feet. All things betray thee who betrayest me. There's no hiding place from God. There is no exhausting his pursuit. And Lewis is acknowledging that. He said, search for God. Does the mouse look for the cat? I see we have a cat somewhere here now. I hadn't seen it for some days. I don't know where it came from. I think someday, unless the cat is on catty, that you may see the cat among the chipmunks. And then, if those chipmunks have any kind of intuition at all, or instinct, they are not going to try to be friendly with a cat. There are times when I wish there were probably a couple of other cats, at least to keep the chipmunk away from my coffee cup. Now, what is this? I am the Lord. There is a strength and a vigor And I want to get some more literature in here. There is something terrible in this, a terror. Many of you, if you do not have Luther's Small Catechism, had something similar and learned about the explanation of the commandments. The commandment is there, a bald, thou shalt not. What does this mean? Some of the words are not too familiar. And our small catechism said, we should fear. First thing. Fear and love God. It looks like we're going to be split personality, doesn't it? Fear and love. Why not just love?
I heard an interesting discussion one night at our church circle that we should not have fear in there, because we should not be afraid of him, because he is all everywhere present, thinking of us. And it was a very interesting discussion, because us old timers, we knew we had the fear, love, and trust.
Why? What kind of a fear?
Then this is where they went on further, that, you know, we should fear for we should be afraid of escaping from him, instead of being afraid of that he's going to punish you. It's kind of the way they came back. I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on that.
Well, how about some others? This is a sticky word, isn't it? Four-letter words are sometimes the hardest to work with. Used afraid, we try that, and we want to qualify that. Some other ideas?
Hold him in awe.
Hold him in awe. Reverence. Probably somebody around the other day, just become acquainted with Susan Kylo. And, of course, I have for a long time been at an age when I don't show the proper reverence to young pastors or interns. For one thing, Ariel, when I was at Our Savior's in Milwaukee, we have the same background there as interns, he tells me. It was one of the Manuelson boys, the older one, who called me, and I was about finishing up my year of internship and going back for a year of seminary, and then I'd be ordained. He called me the almost reverend. There was a young lady here who had been a volunteer, and she was going to, she quit some time ago to go back. She was going to Chicago Lutheran Theological Seminary, and of course, my strange mind and my memory, I called her the, you know, not very reverend. But of course, Susan Kylo comes here, so I walked past her in the coffee line the other day and say, "Hi, Your Reverence." That's a bad use of the term. But there is nothing holy anymore. Has to be asked. And it doesn't mean that we come into church so deadly, inhuman. But it does mean that we don't reach our chairs around the altar rail and put our boots up on the rail. Even that. That's a symbol of something. And the whole attitude. Well, I want to inject something here which sounds even harsher. Terror. I don't want to make too much of it, and something has happened since, about a week or so ago, my wife and I went out for a walk. The farthest we got was about a mile west of here. There's an area there, there's a ball diamond, I guess, or something, if you can play ball. The grass isn't too high, and there's a picnic area. We were walking along, minding our own business, and suddenly we looked out over between us and the river, I call it, was a black bear. And he was just sort of loping along. So we stood still. And he moved on a little bit and then slowed down a little bit. And the wind favored, because it was blowing into our faces and away from him. And he went into the brush and disappeared. Well, we weren't
terrified exactly. Well, we decided that we had walked far enough, and so we would walk. Somebody told me that hunters had been busy up there, and somebody had shot a black bear. I really don't know whether I want him shot or not, but we hold these animals, oh, they are powerful. I don't want to wrestle him or circus. Now here, I've got a book here with a strange title, Descent into Hell by Charles Williams. Williams was a good friend of Lewis's, also had a tremendous imagination, and wrote some, well, religious novels might seem a misnomer, but they have a very strong base in a supernatural view. I wish I could shorten this up, but I don't know how I can. And all revolves around the meaning of terror, terrible. The setting is that a very well-known poet has written a play in verse, and a community sort of drama group is going to produce it. Maybe some of you have experience with this. I don't want to be too harsh, but sometimes, you know, there are people who are drama mad, and there are people who want to produce, and they have their ideas, and Shakespeare is spinning around in his grave at what they have done to him, and other playwrights the same. This man's name is Stanhope, and he obviously has some deep religious convictions, but some other people don't share that, nor the intelligence. There is supposed to be a chorus, which gets to be a big puzzle, because they're trying to nail it down more than Stanhope wants it. I begin to see my way, one lady says, the trees perhaps, leaves, to have the leaves of the wood all so helpful to the young people, so charming. It's a terribly sweet idea, said another young lady, and so true, too. Pauline, who was sitting next to her, said in an undertone, true? Don't you think so? It's what I always feel about trees and flowers and leaves and so on. They're so friendly. Perhaps you don't notice it so much. I'm rather mystic about nature, like Wordsworth. I should love to spend days out with nothing but the trees and the leaves and the wind. Only somehow, one never seems to have time. But I do believe they're all breathing in with us, and it's such a comfort, here where there are so many trees. Of course, we're only to sink into ourselves to find peace, and trees and clouds and so on all help us. One never need be unhappy. Nature's so terribly good. Don't you think so, Mr. Stanhope? Stanhope was standing by silent while Mrs. Perry communed with her soul and with one or two of her neighbors on the possibilities of dressing the chorus. He turned his head and answered, that nature is terribly good? Yes, Miss Fox. You do mean terribly. Why, certainly, Miss Fox said. Terribly, dreadfully, very. Yes, Stanhope said again. Very. Only, you must forgive me, it comes from doing so much writing, but when I say terribly, I think I mean full of terror. A dreadful goodness. I don't see how goodness can be dreadful, Miss Fox said, with a shade of resentment in her voice. If things are good, they're not terrifying, are they? It was you who said terribly, Stanhope reminded her with a smile. I only agreed. And if things are terrifying, Pauline put in, she's the good gal. Her eyes half closed and her head turned away as if she asked a casual question, rather of the world than of him. Can they be good? He looked down on her. Yes, surely, he said, with more energy. Are our tremors to measure the omnipotence? A terrible goodness. Another poet, was he American? Sidney Lanier, talks about Jesus as thou crystal Christ. Perfect. And is not only the word of Christ that overwhelms. Do you remember when his own townspeople were about to set on him and hurl him over the cliff? My, you know, how we do seek God. Jesus moved through them and went. And then there was that man who was sent. Was he some kind of an official? Anyway, you can picture him as a burly sort of a sheriff. And he was told to take Jesus and bring him to account. And he came back empty-handed, and they said, "Where's Jesus?" Never heard a man talk like that. And it wasn't a matter of his talking his way out of a traffic ticket. But there was in him, there is in him, a holiness. Now, I've moved on without proper regard to my notes. There is one further irony. Sort of, where did Lewis sort of get off on this? And what was it that sort of opened the way for this experience of holiness? It was from pagan, Scandinavian, Germanic gods. From Odin and all the rest of that crowd. And they were corrupt, and they were not morally a kind of example that you would find. There is more that I should read here about Lewis's evaluation. In part, he had to sort of find the idea of holiness in the pagan gods, because in the church, as he'd experienced it, there was nothing of that character. And that may explain why some people go loping around to other religions, Eastern, whatever they are, because they find that there is some sensitivity there to a holy God. And they have met nothing but a sort of commonplace, dull God. Well, there is the key thing here in Lewis's own life. And I want to try to find it, but it is sort of a way station on its ultimate conversion. I may have to trust in my memory, because the bell is going to ring. There came a night in his room when he tells us he was really forced to his knees. And what was his admission? Not that he was a great sinner, but that God was God. And then he adds this. I give up. Too many stop sheets. He said, "At that moment, I was the most reluctant convert in all of England." He has been grasped. He's not saying, finally got hold of God. God got hold of him. This God said, "I am who I am." He will also be self-conscious enough to say, "I didn't believe in Jesus. God had him," and the belief in Jesus comes sequentially. This is not a model. It is a matter of saying, this is what happened to me. But the important thing, and one I think that's normative for all of that magnificent religious life of Lewis that we find in his writings, God was a holy God. God was a great God, and never shrunken or small or insignificant. Always a great God. Oh, great thou art. That's the place to stop. And just be on your guard. The bell is going to ring any time now. Thank you.